My name is Robert Cusick, and I'm a longtime student of Gill's, and he asked me if I would come down and talk to you for a little bit tonight. It's very nice to be here with all of you, to see old friends and new friends and new faces. I wanted to, before I begin, I just wanted to ask, I know that there are several people in the room who have meditated for quite some time, but are there people who are fairly new to meditation in the room? Okay, great. All right, so what I thought I would do tonight, and I will give the bio, is I wanted to talk a little bit about intention, the intention that brings us to decide that we want to meditate, and the intention that helps us stay the course once we've made that decision. And I thought that one of the ways that I might want to approach this is to ask your indulgence in allowing me to tell you a little bit about my own path to coming to meditation and what it's meant for me and where I took it up and where it seems to be taking me. So what I'd like to do is I'll begin by telling you when I was a very young man in my late teens and early 20s, I had some brief experience with meditation. And at that time, I was so distracted with the things that young people are distracted by that it wasn't the time in my life for me to be able to meditate with any degree of seriousness or meaning. There were other things that really distracted me. But about 8 or 9 years ago, I went through a series of experiences which resulted in cascading losses for me in my life. And so I found myself in great turmoil, in great despair. And not to put too fine a spin on it, but I was really suffering. I was suffering a lot. And I was in a lot of confusion, but I knew enough to think that if there was ever a time in my life when I could use help, that was the time. And so I looked for a psychotherapist to go to and someone that I could talk to. And as it turned out, this psychotherapist was a Buddhist. And after seeing him for a fairly short period of time, he suggested to me that while it was probably important that we continue working together, that what he thought I really was looking for and yearning for in my heart was something that he wasn't able to give me. And so he asked me if I had any interest in meditating. And I told him that when I was younger, I had meditated for a while, but it wasn't very successful and so on and so forth. And he had a Spirit Rock newsletter in his office. And he suggested that I think about sitting a one-day meditation retreat. And at that point, I thought, meditating for a whole day? Is he out of his mind? How does anybody sit still for a whole day? But anyway, he got the newsletter out and he went down the listing and he found a day long and he said, I think you should see if you can go to this day long. And I'm happy to say, I'll give the credit to Jack Kornfield because he pointed me to a day long with Jack. And I went out to Spirit Rock and I sat for one day with Jack and I didn't know what I was doing. I just decided it didn't make any difference. I would just go and see what happened. And I was really moved by that experience. I was really deeply moved by that experience. And part of why I think that worked for me was that I didn't go with any ideas about what was supposed to happen. I was so beaten up that I didn't care really what happened. I didn't expect anything. So after one day, after meditating for one day and being introduced to walking meditation, I don't know how many of you have ever done walking meditation, but the first time I saw people doing it at Spirit Rock, it reminded me of that zombie movie, The Night of the Living Dead. Really, we're walking so slowly. But where have I come? These people are crazy. But for some reason, something in my heart was really touched. And it was... And I decided that I wanted to meditate. I wanted to meditate in a more consistent, continuous way. But something felt a little bit different about this than when I had made New Year's resolutions. It wasn't like I was, suddenly I'm going to go home and I'm going to sit for an hour in the morning and an hour at night before I go to bed. And, you know, maybe I'll do that for one day and then it falls by the wayside. Something really deeply stirred in me. And I wasn't sure what it was, but this intention to meditate arose really strongly. And so I decided to follow my heart. And at that point, things began to shift because at that point I began to have expectations, which was a sure sign for immediate suffering. Because I imagined that if I sat down in a cushion like this and I crossed my legs and assumed a meditation posture, that suddenly I would have deep meditation experiences. Altered states of consciousness, maybe. But what I got was a sore back and aching knees and a mind that was totally out of control. I felt like a chimpanzee in a cage. And it was really humbling. But still, the intention to sit and to see what it was all about was really pretty strong. So in the beginning, I looked for ways that I could do that in a natural way so that I didn't derail my effort. I had enough maturity at that point just from life experience to know that if I bit off more than I could really do, my good intentions would go by the wayside. So I devised a way that I could sit for 10 or 15 minutes in the morning. And I had this throne of pillows that I put next to my bed. I did sit on the floor, but I had to lean against the side of the bed. And I was about this far away from my television. But it somehow... I closed my eyes and the 15 minutes passed. And so as time went on and I found that I could actually depend on getting myself to the cushion for at least 15 minutes a day, or maybe 15 minutes in the evening as well, I decided to look for a place where I could meditate with other people, because I felt like it was taking a lot of effort to maintain my determination to meditate while I was alone. And I realized that if I had sat down and tried to do a day-long sit by myself, I would have never made it. I would have gotten up and left. But because I was with the whole group at Spirit Rock that day, I was able to be there. So I thought, I will look for a meditation group. And that's what I did. I went back to the Spirit Rock newsletter and I looked for sitting groups. And I lived up in the East Bay in Contra Costa County. And so I found a sitting group that was in Berkeley. And I called the teacher up. The number was listed, and I called the teacher and I asked if I could come, and he said yes, of course, told me where it was and when it was and what the evening was like. And so I went to the sitting group, again following my intention, but not really being clear how powerful this intention was. And I decided that I would come to that group. I would go to that group every Thursday night. It was on a Thursday night as well. But that I wouldn't talk to anyone for at least 1 year. And the reason I did that was because I wanted to really see if it was the practice that called me, if my intention was for the practice and not for friends and companionship that I also needed at that time. Because I'm going to remind you that I was really wounded during this period of time. So I did that. Every Thursday I would go and I would meditate with the group, and I would listen to the teacher give the Dhamma talk. And when the evening was over, I would get up and quietly walk out, and other people would stand around for a few minutes and say, greet one another. And no one ever spoke to me or ever in any way intruded on my silence. And then after 1 year, almost to the week, I got up to leave and someone walked up and said, what's your name? You've been coming for a year and we don't know who you are. So at that point, I figured I had finally arrived. So during that period of time, this whole business of meditation was growing, and it was beginning to take root in my heart in a very profound way. And I had listened to 1 year of Dhamma talks, at least 1 year of Dhamma talks on a weekly basis. So I had not only been meditating, but I had been listening to the Dhamma, and I had begun reading books about meditation and about the Dhamma and about the teachings of the Buddha. And so I guess I was really primed to sort of dive in. It was something that I wanted so much in my heart, that to not recognize it or to not honor it would have been painful for me. And I knew I was really lucky, I was really fortunate to live in the Bay Area, where the teachings were available, where there were so many good teachers. where there were sitting groups, people who filled with people who shared the same kind of ideas and values that I seemed to be cultivating and fostering during that time. And I realized that I had the intention to practice at a deeper level then, that I wanted to do something a little bit more than I was doing, but I wasn't sure exactly how to do that. I was trying to be faithful to a daily practice at home, and I was meeting with my sitting group on Thursday, but still I wanted more. During this first year, I heard the teacher say that he was going to teach a 5-day retreat at Spirit Rock or a 10-day retreat, and I thought, people sit for 5 days, impossible. How could they do such a thing? And he went off, and a group of the people in the sitting group went off on this 5-day retreat. And I thought they all must be, if not enlightened, they were like totally right next door to being enlightened. And I'm happy to say they probably were. But I then saw the example of people practicing in that kind of a context, within a retreat setting, a residential retreat setting, where one goes off and, you know, for a certain period of time, you just put away the things of your life and you give yourself a rest from the world, so to speak. And in these retreats, oftentimes, more often than not, people maintain silence. They actually go into silence until the retreat is over. And boy, I was really curious. I just didn't know what that would mean. But I still was sitting propped up on pillows. I could hardly imagine sitting for 5 days. Anyway, I was still seeing my psychotherapist, and I told him that I had an interest in doing this. And there was a senior students retreat that was being offered at Spirit Rock, and Gil was one of the teachers on that retreat. And there was a prerequisite for the retreat that you had to have sat a retreat of, I don't know, 5 days or something before you could get into this retreat. It was a two-week retreat, and I had never sat an overnight retreat. So I said, well, I probably can't get into that retreat, and I was looking for an easy out. And he said, Robert, didn't you tell me that you made a living by being a salesman? And I said, yes. And he said, well, call the teacher and sell him on the idea that you can get into this retreat and do it. He said, you've got a 50-50 chance. He'll say yes or he'll say no. What do you have to lose? So that's what I did. I called up and I said I wanted to come to this retreat. And the teacher that I actually got wasn't Gil, but it was another teacher. And he really held my feet to the fire. He wanted to know why I would come on a 2-week meditation, why I would work for 50 weeks and then go on a 2-week meditation, silent meditation retreat with my 2-week vacation. And it was, I think the reason he let me in was because I was just so honest with him. I realized in that moment that it was the thing I wanted more than anything in the whole world, and that was to go and try this meditation in a really I don't want to say deep way, but in a container in which everything that was going on was for practice. You know, I would come to my group, and when I'd leave the group, I'd get in my car and I have to deal with traffic on the freeway and I'd have to go to work the next morning. So, but this represented to me an opportunity to just be free from that and then to see what would happen. So he let me come to the retreat, I'm happy to say. And boy, was it a shock. So I guess I thought then that since the cushion didn't work for me, I thought if I went to retreat, for sure I'd really get it immediately. And after the third day of really suffering, he basically told me to relax and calm down. And I said, this breath business, I can't follow my breath, and this isn't working, I have a pain in my back, and maybe this is more than I should have done, and why did I come, and how could you have been so silly as to let me in? And so he taught me a breath technique. He taught me a technique for following my breath, and he made me do it in his office right in front of him while I was having the interview. And then he asked me, does that work for you? Can you stay with the breath at least for a little while? And I could stay with the breath at least for a little while. So it gave me hope. So he said, go and meditate for a day and then come back tomorrow and we'll talk again. So I did that. I was determined that I would at least try my best. And I took his instruction and I went and I put it into practice. And as often happens for people, new people, you can call it beginner's luck or something like that. The next morning I was using his technique and suddenly I dropped into a place of experience which was completely different from anything I had ever experienced in my life before. And this experience went on for quite some time. And it filled me with great happiness and joy. And the nearest thing that I can compare it with is what Christians call rapture. I experienced this sweet, sublime nectar of deepening meditation. And I didn't know what happened, but I thought I must have been turned into a saint or something. Good formula for suffering, because I chased that experience for several years afterwards. I was back to the sore knees and the sore back. It was humbling. But the experience was almost like the carrot on the end of the stick. You know, once I tasted it, I knew that my heart was leading me in the right direction and that it was something that I not only really desired to do, but that I almost couldn't not do. I felt as though in some way I was being carried along. And I remember at one point Gil said to me that, he pointed out to me that I wasn't doing the practice, that the practice was doing me. It's something that many of us have heard many times. And it's such good advice, it's such a good teaching, because I did, and it's my observation from talking with other people and being with other people, that our expectations really get in the way of our meditation, and they really get in the way of our practice. And practice is paradoxical, because without some determination to practice, without some determination to try certain kinds of meditation practices or other kinds of spiritual practices, nothing happens. But the misuse of effort, which is so common when expectations are leading us and motivating us, will absolutely just derail our efforts. So meditation isn't really so much about doing, although you have to do, but it's not about doing, it's not about being anything. It's more about, if I can say this, it's more about receiving. It's more about letting what is arise without getting in the way. And it's not an easy thing to learn when you're full of enthusiasm and the habits of a lifetime. So I simply approached my meditation the way I approached my life. And what worked for me in my career sure didn't work for me in meditation. The attitude of being competitive, of no pain, no gain, of, you know, just driving on, was absolutely the wrong way to go for me. And I think it is for most people. I also want to hasten to say that everybody has a different temperament, and that for someone with a temperament like mine, to drive too hard, to work too hard, is really wrong. I need to relax more, to let the meditation be more natural, to let the technique be natural. Other people are a little bit more laid back. Some people might even be lazy. I spent some time in Burma. I forgot about my bio. I spent some time in Burma where I ordained as a Buddhist monk. And when I was there, I saw that a lot of people in Asia tend to be really pretty loosey-goosey about the way they do things. And so the teacher would be really pretty firm with them. I thought, God, if he ever talked to me like that, I wouldn't know what I would do. I'd be so shocked. But there was one young guy, and he said, "Why do you sit like that? Why don't you sit up straight? You're a man, sit up straight." But what is he doing? If I was the next person in line waiting for the interview, I thought for sure he was going to, you know, chase me out of the monastery. But he was really sweet and kind with me. So everybody has their own temperament, and you sort of have to find what yours is and what works for you and what doesn't work for you. And I've been talking sort of around meditation, which I've also noticed that people do all the time, just because it's so hard to talk about something that's such a private, personal, intimate kind of experience for all of us. But there are things that can be said about meditation and about meditation techniques and meditation practices, which I want to touch on a little bit at this point after I give you a brief bio here. I'm not even sure I told you what my name was. Did I tell you my name? I'm a student of Gill's, as I mentioned, and I practice in the Soto Zen tradition at Tassajara. I lived at Tassajara for a while, and I've done a lot of Western Vipassana style meditation with the teachers at Spirit Rock, with all the teachers at Spirit Rock and at other places. And I also practiced in Burma, in southern Burma, with a Sayadaw there, Pawak Sayadaw, the Venerable Pawak Sayadaw, who teaches a form of concentration. He begins the instruction with what's called Samatha meditation or tranquility meditation, or other people would know it as Samadhi meditation, where one chooses a meditation object and then brings their focus of attention onto this object to the exclusion of everything else. And this sometimes leads to deepening states of concentration. Hopefully it does. And at a certain point, when the concentration, when you've done this sort of course in deepening concentration, then he introduces the Vipassana technique. Because the insight meditation is the practice that will actually, or the Vipassana meditation is the practice that will actually take the meditator all the way to Nibbana or to freedom. And one of the big differences of practicing in Asia that I noticed from my experience in practicing in the West is that because Buddhism is so much a part of the culture there, and people are used to it. They grow up on Buddhism. They're used to seeing monastics. They're just used to it. And so the teachers there are not in any way reticent to mention the word liberation or nirvana. So the idea of practicing in Asia is when you go to a teacher, you go to the teacher so with the idea that this teacher can take you a certain way along the path of your own awakening or all the way to your own awakening. And it was a little bit shocking for me because I didn't know that I was really wanting to be that liberated, especially when I found out what was involved. But there you have it. So I was in Burma with the teacher for about a year, and then I came back about a year and maybe 15 or 16 months ago I returned. And I've just come back now from a two-month retreat where a few people who had been in his monastery, a few people from the Bay Area who had been in his monastery in Burma, put together a retreat, and we actually brought him to America. And he just finished a two-month retreat with us. That was really quite remarkably profound on all levels. And I think it was a wonderful experience for him as well, because so many Westerners did so well in the retreat that he knew that he didn't come to America for nothing. So I'm happy to say it was a very successful retreat. And I work out at Spirit Rock. I'm a retreat manager out at Spirit Rock. And I'm getting ready to return to Burma where I will reordain with the same teacher in July. So that's a brief bio. I finally did it. So what I want to do is take a little bit of time now and talk about some meditation styles or techniques that I've used and that are taught. And this all ties in again with intention, because nothing happens without intention. And intention sometimes reveals temperament, and temperament is sometimes the gateway to finding your own unique path, because it's not the same for everyone. And there's more than one road to Rome, as they say. So here in the West, the Vipassana style technique that many of us have learned is one where we practice the awareness of what's arising for us from moment to moment. So it's a practice wherein if you were sitting in a retreat, for those of you who haven't sat retreats before, it's a practice where you would begin by taking a meditation object such as the breath. The breath is generally the first beginning object that's offered. And you would try to keep your attention and your awareness on the breath for as long as possible. And when the mind wanders away, you are instructed to bring your attention back to the breath in a very sort of matter-of-fact way, to be just straightforward and gentle with yourself. This is generally a good place to notice how you treat yourself. It's a point of discovery, because you can meet your expectations. Oh, there I go again. I can't stay with the breath for more than three breaths. What's the matter with me? Everyone else must be doing incredible meditation, and here I am. But if you just come back to the breath over and over and over again, without any overlay of superego or judgment or attack on yourself at all, sooner or later, your mindfulness will begin to get sharper and brighter. And one of the goals here, if I can say it in that way, is to have the mindfulness be strong enough to keep you with the object in a more or less continuous way, so that eventually you'll begin to notice that things are arising and passing away pretty quickly. So the Buddha taught that we're all subject to experiencing impermanence and dukkha, or suffering, which is probably not the best translation. The quality of things not being just right, the quality of It has the flavor. It can be out and out suffering. It can be pain. It can be suffering. But it can also be sort of rearranging the world that you're experiencing. The experience, your direct experience of the world is somehow not enough for you. And so whatever it is that makes you try to rearrange it or feel discontent, that's got the quality of dukkha to it, you see? And that also that the things that we invest our lives with, the things that we identify with and that we think are ours. You know, I think I'm Robert, I think I was a monk, I think I was a salesman, I think I was neurotic and needed a lot of help. I was all of those things, but when I really look at those things, I can't really find anything that's really permanent there. I can't find a permanent abiding self in that. And so by following the breath, by noticing what happens over and over and over again from mind moment to mind moment to mind moment to mind moment, if you can do this in a continuous way, these qualities of impermanence and non-self and unsatisfactoriness or suffering will begin to sort of reveal themselves to you. And when that begins to happen, there's an opportunity for deep understanding. There's an opportunity for insight that isn't normally available to us. But paradoxically, we have to not over try, but we have to make the effort to bring ourselves to either to the cushion or to some form of practice where these things become they move to the forefront of our attention. So this is one way of practicing, and it's a very effective way. It's a very useful way, and it can take people to tremendously deep places. And it can, in fact, it can take you all the way to freedom. Obviously, as you go along, you would work with the teacher who would guide you in very specific ways as things begin to unfold for you. So this is one way. Then there's the practice of emptiness or choiceless awareness, which could lead to emptiness, which is practiced in the Zen tradition. And it's a little bit harder to talk about that. I don't know, has anyone in this room done Zazen practice? Yeah. So you can correct me when I what I'm going to say. But in the Zazen practice, one is really given no instruction at all. There's an awful lot of instruction on how you come to the cushion, how you enter the zendo, how you bow to the tanto, how you do this and how you do that. But once you're on the cushion, you're basically on your own. Now there are some instructions to settle. Counting is used as one technique, and I'll mention that in a moment. But choiceless awareness is just noticing what's arising in your field of consciousness, in your field of awareness, as it arises and as it passes away, without any preference given to anything. You just notice. And the mere act of sitting is itself a reflection of the enlightened state or your innate Buddha nature, which is something that's key and inherent in the Mahayana tradition or the northern tradition, the Vipassana or the Theravadan tradition that we practice here is found in Southeast Asia, in India, Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, places like that. So the choiceless awareness practice is a little bit like the Vipassana practice, although in Vipassana you really will start off with following the breath, you know. And the Zazen practice is really quite beautiful because you can find yourself, when you do this practice for a long time, touching places of deep stillness within you. And it's really moving. It's quite moving. And when you touch those places, or when those places begin to reveal themselves, there's a knowing of something that's beyond the ordinary day-to-day world that we live in, or consciousness that we live in. The third type of meditation that I want to talk about is the practice that I learned in Burma. And this is it's a samatha practice, it's a concentration practice, and it's very much like the Vipassana practice, but where in the Vipassana practice you would look at things as they arise and pass away, you might be noticing that you're thinking, you might be noticing that you're having certain body sensations, you might be noticing that you might notice the breath come and go, you might notice sounds, hear someone cough, hear a car outside. All of this is incorporated into the meditation. But in the samatha practice, what happens is that all of those things recede into the background. They don't necessarily go away, but they just recede into the background. So I'm talking to you here, and maybe you're listening. I hope you're listening. And cars will be passing out on the road, and you'll hear a horn honk or something. But really, your attention is on what I'm saying or on me. And it's that kind of practice. And so when one is doing the samatha practice, the instruction is to take an object, if it's the breath, and to let your attention rest simply on the breath. And when the mind wanders away, you just bring it back the same as you would in Vipassana. But you don't take multiple objects for your meditation. So you're taught to bring things down to a single point. So it's actually quite easy. It's not so simple to pull off, but it's really quite an easy instruction. You simply notice the breath at a certain point, generally at the upper lip, and you find the touch point, and then you just know the breath at this point, and that becomes what holds your awareness for the duration of the meditation. Now, immediately the mind is going to wander off and you'll have to bring it back. But what you do is you just come back to this single point. So you're not noticing, you're not you're not noticing all the different subtleties of the breath. You're simply noticing, breathing, period. And this obviously, it's not quite that simple, and I don't have enough time to really go into it. But what happens is that as your attention stabilizes and as your concentration begins to develop, certain signs of concentration will appear. And one sign that appears that is a sure giveaway that something is happening is that you begin to feel tranquil. So it's called the tranquility meditation because it often makes you, you're sort of eliminating so everything else. So you give yourself a chance to really rest and to be in this space of rest is it's a happy, tranquil kind of feeling. So different temperaments would be inclined to these three different approaches that I've discussed, and there are many, many more types of meditation, just as valid as any of these three. But it's useful as one starts off on a career of meditating to see what actually resonates for you, what makes sense to you, what, you know, lights your fire. And to not forget that enjoyment, to enjoy the meditation, is really okay. It's not just okay, it's really recommended. Because you're not going to meditate for very long if it's a big pain in the neck. Literally, you're not going to do it. And unless you're really driven like I was driven. So I suffered and suffered and suffered and had to go through countless humiliations to get to a place where I could finally... I'm still getting there, where I can finally begin to let go and see what I'm doing, see how I'm setting myself up to frustrate myself and to present obstacles in my way. So I've talked for quite a while and we have just a few minutes left here, but I would like to open this up to any questions that any of you may have. And I welcome, I don't know the answer to all your questions, but if I do, I'll certainly try to answer anything you have. Any questions about a meditation in particular or about your practice or your intention? Okay.
Sometimes when I concentrate on my breath, the cool air going through my nose, my eyes focus here.
Yeah.
And sometimes they start hurting. I think I'm trying to look at that point.
With your physical eyes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean they're closed, of course.
Mm-hmm. I understand.
But they're focused. And they hurt because I think I've crossed them or something. And I just wonder, do you ever deal with the eyes? Sometimes I'm real conscious of my eyes.
Yeah, sure. It's completely natural. what I would say is that that's a sign that you're over-efforting. You're behaving like I do. So what I would suggest is that you try really consciously to relax your eyes, to just close your eyes and relax your eyes. And what you want to do is find this touch point or to find the breath with your mind's eye. You see, not your physical eye, but your mind's eye. So it's as though you can like go into your head. This is all. And look with that eye. That eye won't get strained. As soon as you feel tension in your face, you want to try to relax that. I wouldn't pursue that very far at all. I would consciously step back and relax. You're not doing anything wrong. You're not going to harm yourself. But this is not something that we're doing with our physical eyes. It's something that we're doing with our mind's eye. Try it and see what happens.
You said you had a teacher at the retreat.
Could you speak up?
Your 2-week retreat, you said you had a teacher when you were having a hard time focusing that gave you a breathing.
That worked, right. Okay. So I had gone in and I basically reported that I couldn't concentrate for more than 2 breaths at a time. And I was at that time a volunteer caregiver at the Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco. And so I'd been working with people who were dying, and it was work that was really close to my heart. And so he gave me a technique where as I would take a breath, he told me to imagine that was the first breath of my life, that was my birth breath. And when I took the next breath, he told me to imagine that was the last breath of my life, that was my death breath. And what would it be like to imagine my birth and my death? What would it be like to experience my birth moment and my death moment through my breath? And that's what I did. I used that, and for that particular time, it actually worked for me. But you'll be given, when you work with teachers, they'll give you all sorts of very skillful instructions. That was a very skillful instruction for me, because I was beside myself. And, you know, after that happened, there was no stopping me. You had a question? Speak up, because I have a...
I think you mentioned back pain at some point when you were talking, and one of the things that has kept me sort of coming and going in relationship to meditation is back pain also.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if you have any experience how you integrate, how one would integrate back pain into the experience of meditation and what you focus on, what to do with that, focus okay. on it or not focus on it.
Right. Sure, sure. Well, you want to ask several people that question, because that's a big question that you've just asked. There's several questions in there. The first thing that I would do is I'll give you like a really brief instructions for how to sit in meditation, which is essentially the way that I'm sitting. But if you're going to, do you meditate on a cushion or on the chair? Do you sit on the floor when you meditate, though? Okay, so Gil taught me this. To sit up a little bit higher. Some people do just fine on low cushions, but I need to sit up a little bit higher. And your knees should be down as far as they'll go. If they don't go down, you can put a little cushion under your knee, like that. And basically, you just want to assume a comfortable upright position. And I always do this by closing my eyes and in my mind's eye, actually picturing what my spine looks like. And the idea is to just sort of relax into letting your spine take a natural upright position with an S curve in the back. I mean, you don't want to be like a board, because you'll get uncomfortable. But you want to take a very comfortable position. And a technique that I learned at Tassajara was to imagine my ears in line with my shoulders, in line with my hips, and my nose in line with my navel. And once I have that alignment, then I just, you know, take a deep breath, and sometimes, not always, I'll actually feel the muscles in my back, I guess, relax, and my shoulder blades will drop down my back. My chest actually feels like it raises up. I'm not actually doing this consciously. It'll just raise up. And then your head just drops slightly. It'll just come forward slightly. And then you just sit with that for a moment and feel if you're comfortable. And then when you are, you can settle into it. If you're sitting in the chair, it would be the same kind of thing. You want a straight position. You can do the ear thing and the nose thing. Keep both feet flat on the floor, and your hands can be in a formal mudra or on your, any way that's comfortable, you can do. So that's the first answer to that question. The second answer is that if you're really, really uncomfortable, by all means, change your position. Just do it quietly and mindfully. And if you're just mildly restless, you might want to sit with that and see what happens. So the bottom line is, don't suffer needlessly and don't sit through anything that's really so painful that you could hurt yourself. Okay? Any other questions? Yes?
I was just wondering if you could say a few words about your process of like noticing and labeling objects in the process.
The labeling process? Well, that's a good question for me because I don't use that process in my meditation. I'm one of those people that find that distracting. Many people find that very, very, very useful, and I understand from those people that when they're using the noting practice, it's that they're noting with a small part of their mind, but their attention is on what they're actually noting. So it's not like, for me, the minute I start that, I lose the object and I'm counting 1, 2, 3, 4, or I'm doing something like that. So I don't find that practice helpful for me. But I think that what I've just told you about the noting practice is in fact the way. Would you agree that that's right, or would you add anything to that? It's you want to keep your awareness on what is arising and not on the actual note. The note is only to remind you what's happening. So if you can, you know, I've heard it like 95 or 97% on the object and 5% on bowl, whatever it is that you're noting. Do you use the noting practice?
Yeah, I struggle with it at times, so that's...
What is the struggle?
I think I do put more attention on trying to label it accurately, you know, by trying to discern what is it that the object actually is.
Sure. Well, I would really encourage you not to de-emphasize your direct physical experience. And I would just ask you, I would ask all of you to think about when you're meditating, when your mind wanders, Are you in your body, or are you in your mind? Where are you when your mind wanders? Where are you when you get lost? When you're in your body, you cannot get lost. It's impossible to get lost if you're grounded in your body. So one of the things that happens in meditation is that you have an opportunity in our busy lives to bring our minds and our bodies to the same place at the same time so that they become unified, and at least in some way they begin to be unified, and we can have this experience of release and relaxation that comes from being in a harmonious state like that. But this is a really, I'm glad you brought that up, or you mentioned that, because I wanted to say this in the talk tonight, and I guess I didn't find a place to stick it in. As long as you are grounded in your body, you're safe. And your meditation will be what it is. It can have the opportunity to be really sweet. But as soon as you start to drift away, as soon as you notice that you've drifted away, you'll know that you're not in your body anymore. Something that I did in my own meditation was I began to notice that. And so I began to reflect on what it felt like when I was, what my body felt like, what I felt like directly in as a physical experience when I was with, when I was present with the object, with the object of my mindfulness. And then what it felt like in my body when I was not with my mindfulness object. So I literally created situations in my mind where I would think about a future event, or I would recall a past event, just to see what the actual experience in the felt sense in my body was like when I was out there in the future or in the past, as opposed to what it was like when I was directly here in the present moment. And that is a very, very surefire way of bringing yourself right back into the center of your meditation. Okay, so it's really been wonderful being here with all of you. And thank you for indulging me and letting me tell you a little bit of my story. And I'm not sure, are we finished now? We are finished now. Okay. We went a little bit longer. It's about 8 minutes after nine. So thank you all. And I wish you safe travels wherever you're going. And may the merit of whatever good actions we did here tonight, may we share that merit with all beings everywhere, with all of you and with all beings everywhere. Thank you.